Get energized and excited to tell the world, hey, you can call me Catholic. Live from the Christ Cathedral Campus in Garden Grove, California, EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Orange County Catholic Radio present Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, if there is any excellence, and if there is anything worthy of praise, we have been advised by St. Paul to think about these things. In other words, lean into the light. Lean into those places where we recognize God's good influence. We can see clearly the places where God's influence has been pretty much voided, so don't go there. Dwell in the light. Be the light, actually. And here on Call Me Catholic each week, we try to offer up some conversation worthy of St. Paul's instruction to the Philippians that we open the show with every single week. So, warning, good stuff ahead. I am Peggy Normandin, and you have arrived at Call Me Catholic, an hour of lively, hopefully lively dialogue intended to affirm, explore, and celebrate our Catholic identity in these modern times so we can wake up and say to the world each and every day, oh yeah, you can call me Catholic. Jimmy G, my engineer and chief fact checker, is right here with me, sitting across the desk, minding the dials.
Good morning, good morning.
How are you?
Doing great.
Good. Today is the feast day of a saint who should be considered one of our patrons, Jimmy G. Saint Clare.
Saint Clare.
She is the patron saint of broadcasters. You know, interesting too, Saint Clare as Santa Clara and the whole Silicon Valley up in California where all the tech businesses have settled and it's booming. That is really Santa Clara. That's Santa Clara Valley. That was where the beautiful mission in the 1770s, was established as Santa Clara. And now Silicon Valley has totally taken it over. You know, even hijacked the name.
I actually knew it before you said it. It was St. Clair's feast day today because I heard it on the radio.
Yes, I'm sure. I wasn't testing you.
I was prepared.
You were just sort of thought that was a rhetorical question that I was going to answer. But, you know, she's the patron saint of broadcasters, sort of interestingly, even though she was a cloistered nun, because when she lived in Italy and she cloistered herself there in the 1200s, there was some assault by some infidels that were coming to attack the convent where she resided with her other sisters, the poor Clairs. And she had a monstrance and she went to the window and she just held the monstrance out at the window toward the invaders, and they ran away.
Amazing.
So she broadcast the good news, the goodness of Jesus, and they took heal.
Hallelujah.
Yeah. Hey, Jimmy G and I are coming to you from high atop the Tower of Hope on the beautiful, shimmering Christ Cathedral campus in the Diocese of Orange, Orange County, California, where, unfortunately, the world knows us right now for the fires that are raging throughout our state. It's rather terrifying, don't you think?
It's been nonstop. Yeah, just crazy. Just the little viral videos I've been seeing with smoke and everything.
Nearly 14,000 firefighters are out there battling 18 wildfires from Northern California all the way down to Southern California, in excess of 800,000 acres burning. And that is more than twice the amount that had burned at this time last year. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, this is all before, you know, what we consider to be our prime peak fire season, which is September and October. You know, one of the new areas that developed fire, firestorm was an area called the Holy Jim. So they were calling it the Holy Jim Fire. And I'd never heard of it. It's down there by, in the Cleveland National Forest. But there's apparently a road called Holy Jim Canyon Road. And it's kind of like hurricanes, you know, that are alphabetical. These names of the fires they identify, they grab something from the local area and then they just describe it. So now it's just that area is called the Holy Fire. Which, you know, should bode well for it, I would think.
I can imagine when I first saw that name, I thought, wait a second, is someone pulling my leg here?
Well, I know you're a Holy Jim. I'm married to a Holy Jim. So, start praying about that fire. Put it out, would you?
I've been praying.
You know, and even fires near our beautiful, state park, Yosemite. Mm. So it's terrifying and it's sad. And I am so sorry. The one of the kind of beautiful, weird benefits of the fires is that we have these amazing sunsets and sunrises. So as the day turns into dusk, you can really see the redness of the sky against the flames, against
That's right.
the sky.
That's right.
And it's this eerie contrast of the blue sky with the residue of the flames. And it, ironically, it just creates these beautiful sunsets and sunrises, too. So the airborne dust and haze kind of float into the atmosphere and create these layers of colors that are just very, very rich. Smog and fog in the morning make the sun kind of look like it's just appearing out of nowhere, just sort of floating there, which it kind of is.
And all the ash on your car, too. So, yeah.
You know, it's that weird beauty in the midst of terror. And we know, you know, that in all good things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Those are still tough words for those who are in the midst of this firestorm in California, but we pray you find safety and solace in the company of your family, of friends, of generous strangers, and there are plenty of those out there. And that our dear, brave firemen continue to find the strength and the courage and the endurance to keep battling those fires, keep going out there with all that equipment.
Absolutely.
In the heat. So Saint Florian, pray for our firefighters, intercede for them. He is the patron saint of firefighters. Okay, so now I just returned from a wonderful little family vacation in Oregon, where we were kind of out in beautiful wilderness. We attended a wedding in Mount Hood, Oregon, and that's the very, very large peak on the West Coast. Absolutely stunning settings. And then we went from there. We took our families, our newly expanded family of six, because we have a new daughter-in-law.
That's right.
And we drove out to Bend, Oregon, for three nights, where we rented a house and just had such a great time. But, you know, we live in Orange County here, where there's bright lights all the time. So going out into the darkness of, like, Mount Hood and then out in Bend, where the lights go off at night and it's really, really dark, you realize, wow, you know, pitch darkness is kind of scary. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience when you are on vacation in a strange place and it's out in the wilderness. I mean, we've spent time in Wyoming and Montana, and it gets dark out there. And you wake up in the middle of the night and need to get up and visit the facilities. And it's so pitch dark that I couldn't see anything. And at one point I got up in our bedroom and I was knocking things over because there was no residual light coming from anywhere.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, a state of darkness is never good in itself. It's really kind of scary. Only insofar as it kind of affords the brilliance of a light. So one tiny little bit of light can just change the whole panorama for you.
One little light from your cell phone.
That little light of mine. I know, but you can't even find your cell phone sometimes. You're just grabbing at the wall trying to find that switch.
Exactly.
But when you are in that much darkness, you realize darkness is kind of scary. Mm. It's just that little bit of light that you need to be. You know, it offers
exactly.
that affordability. It shows you the power of one tiny little match, one tiny little glimmer of light.
True.
So the sinister qualities of darkness are really well depicted in the tales of vampires. Now that's a pretty big transition.
Right? Where are we
and
going?
And werewolves, who are known to only manifest themselves in darkness, complete darkness. Now what I know about vampires and werewolves wouldn't fill the smallest ampule of blood. But we have a guest today who's coming up, and she knows a lot about this subject. Fortunately, from an historical and Catholic perspective. In fact, Eleanor Borg Nicholson has a new novel out called A Bloody Habit, and it's a spiritual fiction thriller about vampires and minions roaming Victorian London and a faithful team of Dominican friars whose vocation is to rid the world of these evil creatures and save a lot of souls in the process. I think she's going to illuminate for us this subject. And what do we as Catholics believe about the vampire phenomenon? So she's going to, you know, I have much to learn on this subject.
It's going to be a bloody good Call Me Catholic.
It could be a bloody good time. Good conversation. I love good fiction. So I'm looking forward to my conversation with Eleanor Borg Nicholson coming up in just a minute. But first up, it's our Call Me Catholic countdown. And since we're talking about dispelling the darkness, I thought I'd throw out for consideration what I perceive to be five big arenas where darkness lurks. Danger, danger, darkness lurks in the modern world.
Hmm.
So kind of a unique. I mean, it's obviously a very subjective list of places where I think darkness lurks in our modern world. But here we go anyway.
The Call Me
Catholic
countdown.
A little mellow Call Me Catholic countdown intro. Okay. So number five, these are kind of unlikely places of darkness, and obviously we have to be aware of them. Our calendars can be places of darkness. When you open up your calendar, and I'm still old school, I have a written calendar and I open up and write things in, and you see nothing but ink on every page, you know, nothing but filled in boxes. You realize, you know, that can make you kind of despair, you know, and it can make you sort of feel that there's no room for anything. You're just driven. And I think, the antidote to that, the way to bring a little light into your calendar is to just simply do that. Create some spaces, schedule in some empty spaces where you can either sit and pray, or you can sit and contemplate, or you can just take a walk. Just do something that's kind of unscheduled, lowering your blood pressure a little bit and making you kind of come to terms with the realities around you instead of just being driven by them.
Okay. I like that.
Yeah, okay. So that's my number five. Sort of unlikely place where darkness lurks is our calendars. Number four is, I would have to say, pop culture. Now, pop culture creates false idolatry. I mean, in modern world, I think more than ever. I mean, there have been famous actresses, adored singers, artists, you know, people that are beloved and sort of worshipped for their great talent throughout history. But no more so than right now. And the level of talent at which they are worshipped seems to be getting shallower and shallower. Mm. So I feel like when we get too wrapped up in our pop culture and just what is the current trend, what is everybody loving right now, we forget to love that which is truth and that which is true beauty. So what is the antidote to that? Well, I say incorporate into your pop culture following a little, you know, classic culture. Go back in time and appreciate some of the art of previous ages, some movies, old classic movies, even beautiful classic music. I think it will purify your understanding of what art truly is and where God resides in the true beauty and goodness of true beauty, you know, and that's
good advice.
Okay. So yeah. There you go. Pop culture versus classic culture. Okay. Number three, I think darkness can sometimes lurk in the company we keep, you know, and I think you know it from when you're a child to when you're a senior citizen. You know, when you are keeping company that does not bring out the best in you or in fact lead you down paths that you should not be going, you know, kind of encourages bad traits, even sinful behavior in you. And I think that that's not to put that on the person, but sometimes darkness can fester in poorly formed relationships. Hmm. So I think the antidote to that, the lightness in there, is to cultivate a relationship with your guardian angel. I've said it before, but your guardian angel is only going to infuse goodness into your life and only going to give you good counsel, good guidance. You know, evidence of the existence of guardian angels we have in Old Scripture and New Scripture, Old Testament and New Testament. It's right there, scripturally founded. We do have a guardian angel. And our guardian angel may at times help us find a parking place or avoid serious danger. But the angel has a providential purpose that sort of supersedes the earthly stuff and that we tend to focus on. But I do think that they will always steer us in the right direction if we have a conversation with them. They are good company, and if called upon, they might help you discern the best human company to keep and avoid the darkness. Okay. Number two, I'd have to say artificial stimulants in modern culture are really a place of darkness. I think the world we've created right now is full of so much false stimulation for our senses. You know, even through food. If you ever read the book Fast Food Nation, which came out maybe about 20 years ago, it talks about how natural ingredients, foods are labeled with natural ingredients, but they're hyped up with so much of the natural ingredient that it stimulates our senses into thinking that strawberry really tastes like, whoa, you know, a strawberry on steroids, and that's not natural. So and we do the same thing with music, with video games, entertainment of all sorts, the phone, texting and stuff like that. We just seem to want to always be prompted into sort of sensory excitement. And I do think that can create some dark trends toward dependence upon chemical addictions, alcohol or drugs, things that artificially stimulate us so that can keep us kind of adrenaline full. Mm. And that's not good.
True.
So the light antidote to that is the rosary. The rosary is a great answer to sort of artificial stimulation. In addition to the grace that you receive from having a conversation with our Blessed Mother, it has a very soothing, calming repetitiveness that is an excellent opportunity, gateway to seeing the light of Christ, to quelling the darkness. Okay. And number one is, yeah, folks, I'm going to say the internet. The internet is just a super duper big source of darkness. Yes, there is great light in the internet, and there is great goodness. It's a rich, rich resource for knowledge, for connection, for entertainment, even wholesome entertainment. But it also has there around every corner. It's out to get you with stuff that is going to lead you down a rabbit hole that is not good for you, that is very, very dark. So if you find yourself spending too much time in that internet, my advice is Get a hobby, kids. Get a hobby. I mean, I don't care whether you want to take up knitting, archery, cycling, cooking, gardening, photography. Find another more organic way to pass the time, and I think you will see the light. I think you will find God's light.
Amen.
Okay, there you have it. My top five dangerous sources of darkness in the world. But remember, darkness often helps to magnify the light if you see it. So let's refer back to those words of St. Paul that open our show every week. Whatever is true, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, think about those things. Well, next, we are going to tiptoe with our torches into the dark and sinister world of vampires. Apparently, they do exist, and our guest, Eleanor Borg Nicholson, is going to guide us, enlighten us, if you will, through the grim facts about this evil underworld as laid out in her new novel, A Bloody Habit, a gripping and thrilling fictional tale about the vampire phenomenon in Victorian England and the Dominican Order who waged a successful battle against them. So stay with us. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to Call Me Catholic on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Helping you navigate the daily struggles and blessings of life. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Hello, everybody, and I hope you are well on this fine Saturday in August. I am Peggy Normandin, and today on Call Me Catholic, we are going gothic. Yes, we are venturing into We've got a guest on the line who keeps slipping away. It's kind of spooky to me.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to try to venture into the dark world of vampires and animated corpses. But we have a noble guy that we're trying to reach who's going to be our tour facilitator through this kind of questionable subject. Now, we're trying to reach Ellen Borg Nicholson. We keep getting her on the line, and then she keeps dropping off. It sounds like something sinister is at play here, Jimmy G.
So, yeah, our listeners can tell that we're asking for a little prayer so we can make this connection.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a little background on her. She is the author, Eleanor Borg Nicholson, is the author of a real 19th century gothic vampire story called A Bloody Habit. It is a thriller set in Victorian London with a cast of characters worthy of a Dickens novel. A Bloody Habit is a bit terrifying in its plot, but it presents an authentic historical narrative on the origins of the vampire state and the very gritty battle waged by the Dominican Order against this evil phenomenon. Now, Eleanor Borg Nicholson is a very accomplished writer, and I'm fascinated to talk with her about this subject because I really did think that vampires were strictly fictional. I thought they were just an invention of Bram Stoker through his book Dracula, and it was kind of a very unsavory sort of horror plot that I had absolutely no interest in following. But after reading this book, and it had great reviews, and of course it's published by Ignatius Press, and it has reviews that sort of state that it gives the Catholic historical origins of the vampire state. I thought, well, wow, this sounds fascinating. So what I got were two things in reading this novel. I got, number one, a great story that was told in Victorian London, and I love that era. But number two, some interesting history that I can't wait to talk to the author about regarding the Catholic Church's relationship with vampires and the credibility therein. And I think if we're lucky and the vampires stay away, we have got Eleanor Borg Nicholson on the line. Eleanor, are you with us?
I am with you, and I won't put down my garlic or my steak, so we should be fine.
Are you going to stay with us?
I hope so. I hope so. Thank you so much. I'm sorry it took me a second to find a safe vampire-free zone.
Yeah, absolutely. They're after you. Well, okay, so I'm going to get to some questions right away. Your book is called A Bloody Habit. First, I want to ask you what I know because I read the book. What does a bloody habit mean, and why did you choose that for the title of your book?
It was a little bit tongue-in-cheek on my part because it's referring, of course, to the idea that a Dominican friar wearing white dispatching vampires would get blood all over his habit. Mm-hmm. And there's a reference to this in a text written by one of the Dominicans, and my narrator comes across the text. My narrator's very cynical. He's not a person of faith at all.
No.
So encountering the
He's
Dominican
a lawyer.
Exactly. Very matter-of-fact, very late Victorian. I mean, he's a product of the Enlightenment. He doesn't believe this nonsense, so the Dominicans are, frankly, more terrifying to him than the vampires. But so it's basically referring to this notion, and it's part of, there's a header quote for the book from this text, and it says that this notion of the bloodiness of the scapular of the Dominican indicating that he's a really advanced vampire slayer is actually apocryphal.
Okay.
So, but it's referring to those nice white habits stained with blood.
Yeah, well, they get right into the fray is the thing. So, Eleanor, I mean, I read the book. I've got to tell you, I read it from front to back. And at one point I was going to bed with it. My husband said, does it scare you? Because I do get scared easily. And I said, no, I am not scared. I'm fascinated by this. And I said, I love Jesus. I love Jesus. I love Jesus. Good night. You know, but you set it up, and I'm going to give our listeners a little bit of an understanding of it, is that you go chapter by chapter telling the story, and every chapter begins with an excerpt from the novel Dracula, which is Bram Stoker's kind of turn of the century horror book about vampires. And then it really correlates with this story that you have crafted about an attorney living in Victorian England that ends up colliding with all these characters who are, you know, sort of in bed with this evil force. So, in the end, the Dominican, and it's interwoven through all of it, is this little band of Dominican friars who are, it's their vocation to try and intercept these evil forces and thwart them. So how much of this could have actually happened in 1900 London?
Well, the Dominicans were a force in Victorian London. Most of them were doing normal Catholic things like confessing the sacraments, or my chief vampire slayer is actually an historian. And at one point I know there's a lot of action going on and he's absent, and the protagonist narrator is a little frustrated, imagining that he's probably doing something so unimportant, like, I don't know, giving someone extreme unction or something. But instead of, the vampires are here, but for the Dominicans, of course, they confect the Eucharist every day. They're not the vampire. That's their secondary job. It's like a minor apostolate. But in terms of the
historical accuracy of that.
Accuracy. There's a lot. For example, the depictions of the Freemasons, that's pretty accurate. I did invent some characters. Some of the references in the 17th century text, there actually is a papal document where Pope Benedict XIV, in his discussion of the proper treatment of the bodies of saints, addresses the proper treatment of bodies believed to be vampiric, because there was a wave of anti-vampire hysteria in the 17th century following on the heels of the Enlightenment. And the Pope was writing and saying, stop digging up corpses and staking them. Stop. This is, you know, this is
not a healthy pastime.
So a lot of that, and even some quotations that I pulled from Aquinas, and I'm using a little cheekily in there, that's all straight Aquinas. There were a lot of late Victorian attempts to understand the preternatural. And
and Eleanor, define what you would, how would you define preternatural for our listeners?
The preternatural it's where you would put vampire monsters, things like the bump in the night, ghostly emanation. So the supernatural, of course, refers to God, and it's all beyond. But the preternatural is something that, in a sort of concrete way, invades our lives. Actually, the preternatural, you could say, is the lowest point that would be the attention of the exorcist.
Okay.
And I should say, since you mentioned being scared, I have very Victorian sensibilities. So at the point when I started to get scared, I usually had to stop writing. And as you know, I get to the point where the exorcists have a job to do, and then I let them do their job.
Yeah. You don't go there. I know you. They go behind the doors, and the attorney doesn't follow them.
Yes, I can't handle that sort of thing. I did make sure that I was not in conflict with the laws of demonology or what an exorcist would do, in as much as I could stomach investigating it. Since it's not my job, I very much believe in the purification of my imagination.
Yeah, good.
So even the depiction of the sort of ranks of vampires or demonology, a lot of that I created, but it's based on structures that you would get in Aquinas. It's based on so natural philosophy. My husband's actually a philosopher, so I kept going to him and saying, does this make sense? Does that make sense? And various vampire texts that were written over the 18th and 19th century, where people were trying to understand usually odd things happening in nature, you know, bodies that aren't decaying properly because of the quality of the ground. But there is still, as Catholics, we believe, you can see the influence of evil. So it's sort of combining that imaginative realm of vampires with the knowledge that evil is a force and does seek to work in the world. So that's where I was sort of teetering on both But the period is so, it's just a treasure trove for this sort of story.
Oh, yeah. Victorian England is that kind of, we are not amused to rumphing, and this is just absolutely out of the realm of normalcy.
But notice, too, how many of them, they were so addicted to the occult.
Yeah, yeah.
They were so addicted to the occult, but it was this thing they sort of played around with.
Yeah.
Which is so terrifying and disturbing, but they did. There's a line in Dracula where Van Helsing says, London, 19th century London, this is the place of all the world of most promise to Dracula.
Mm.
And I think it's because there's a line from the decadent French decadent writer Baudelaire where he says, the devil's greatest trick is to make man believe he doesn't exist. And the Victorians don't believe that the devil exists.
Yeah, yeah.
So he can just have a field day.
Now, Eleanor, will you stay with us so we can continue this terrifying conversation about the origin and history of vampires as laid out in your new novel, A Bloody Habit? You'll stay with us, right?
I will.
Okay, great. And you stay with us too, listeners. In fact, you can give us a call if you have something to contribute to this conversation, 714-282-6034, 714-282-6034. The subject is vampires. I'll be right back with author Eleanor Borg Nicholson. I'm Peggy Normandin, and you're listening to Call Me Catholic on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Celebrating, exploring, and restoring our Catholic identity. This is Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to a kind of creepy gothic edition of Call Me Catholic. Creepy insofar as we are talking about vampires today. No, it's not Halloween, and I'm not kidding. Vampires are the focus of a new novel by Eleanor Borg Nicholson. It's called A Bloody Habit, and it's a dark tale of villainous vampires, mysterious strangers, animated corpses, and bloody battles. The heroes are a small band of Dominican friars whose ministry is to confront and dissipate these evil creatures, and more importantly, save as many souls as they can along the way. So, Eleanor, let's resume this conversation. What prompted you to write this novel, this fictional novel? You were obviously a big fan of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yes, well, and my background is Victorian, both as a Catholic homeschooler. That was, in reading all the greats, the period I really, really connected with was the Victorians, and I spent a lot of time in college on them. But I was fascinated by the Gothic genre. This particular novel grew out of my interest, not just in Dracula, which sort of haunted me for a while before I started the book, but particularly I was on retreat in, I think it was 2010, Dominican nuns, and I was on a working retreat writing, and a Dominican friar I know came and joined me. Well, he was there to teach the nuns, but he joined me for dinner, and we were chatting, and a very brilliant man, so I was trying to sound intelligent, and he said, there's one thing you have to do on retreat. You have to take a nap. So I thought, oh, well, I'm not really a napper, but I'll try it. And then I was working the next day, looked up, and they had an image of Veronica's veil. So it looks like a disembodied floating head of Jesus on a gold background.
Right.
And I wasn't even working on vampires at the time, but I looked up and thought, if Catholics battle vampires more effectively than anyone else, it's because they're weirder than vampires. And then I lay down.
I resemble that.
I had a nightmare, and I woke up and wrote the first chapter. So the book is partly dedicated to Father Thomas Joseph White. I almost said Father Thomas Edmund Gilroy.
Yeah, right. That's your hero. That's your hero.
I do a lot of tripping on that one. But then as the story unfolded, when it was finished, really, I was able to look back and go, there's a lot that wasn't intentional on my part that makes sense in this story in terms of pairing Dominicans and vampires and my interest in Dracula, but also my interest in the period and my interest in the Gothic. As a Catholic, I think it's a huge tool for sort of unconscious evangelization, especially because the fantasy crowd is really interested in the faith and fantasy mashup, because people are yearning for something beyond what they perceive or experience. And if they want something beyond this, the Gothic lets you play with that idea in a way that you can't. I mean, if you wrote a novel that was just, I don't know, a little love story and it's set in contemporary times, which I can't write contemporary times, so just my imagination breaks down. But you can't then have people talking about life and death and redemption and good and evil. Mm-hmm. You can't have those in conversation. This would be a cheesy novel, but in the Gothic. I can talk about all those things.
Yeah. Well, and it really becomes evil manifest. You know, evil is in the world, but we don't see it. It's disguised. But in this kind of a plot, in this kind of a narrative, you see it. It's there. It's palpable. And it, you know, it's a metaphor for, even though it is historically accurate in many ways, it is also a metaphor for the fact that evil is constantly trying to prey on us and prey on our innocence and prey on our weakness all the time. It's a battle all the time.
There's another, the other Catholic vampire novelist, Karen Yulo, who wrote Jennifer the Damned, a really magnificent exploration of a teenager with vampiric tendencies who starts acting on them. I love, one day she was in an interview and she said that monstrousness, we believe in monstrousness because we're fallen. We live with ourselves. We know what's monstrous. We know what's evil. And really depicting evil and giving it its chance to be put in flesh also gives you the opportunity to show goodness, which is so hard to convey. Most people don't even bother, or they make it cloying, or it's just lame. I mean, you can depict goodness, which I think it's one of the points I came away with afterwards. I think my book is about goodness because it's what stands firm in the face of horror. Mm-hmm. It's what retains hope in the face of horror.
Mm-hmm. You know, how dangerous, though, Eleanor, is some of this other vampire fiction that's come out, like Twilight, that really kind of romanticizes the villain, the evil, makes it look attractive and seductive. How do you feel about some of those modern interpretations?
I think they're very dangerous, but they're following on the heels of a very long sort of a counter history of the vampire. And you see this arising. Stoker walked away from it largely when he wrote Dracula. But if you look at the origins of the vampire novel, really you need to go back to the Dark Romantics. When Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, mm-hmm. it came from the same summer when she was staying with Lord Byron, Shelley, and Polidori, Byron's lawyer, who he later, I'm sorry, doctor, who he later fired. But Polidori wrote a story called The Vampire. And it was largely based on the dynamic, attractive, charismatic, highly amoral character of Lord Byron.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a seductive side. And this idea that evil is sexy, evil wears black, evil's what you want,
mm-hmm.
it's taking the notion that we are tempted towards evil, we are broken and wounded in our nature because of original sin, but it takes away the fact that properly ordered we desire the good and just says, oh, you actually want fulfillment that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for most of the modern corruptions of the vampire that we see, it's because people have not been raised to think that they need to that they need redemption. They are looking for justification mm-hmm. and indulgence of dark pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I said to my husband, the thing that we've come to in modern culture is that nothing is wrong. I mean, everything, you know, like you said, everything is sort of justified, and that's a very desirable state for the evil one. I mean, that's exactly where he wants us. As you said earlier, he wants us to think he doesn't exist.
And I think there's this, with the way that vampires, there's also a very particular social problem that arises from it. And it's the glorification of the bad boy.
Mm-hmm.
Why should girls, the attraction for someone who is the bad boy, who is dangerous, who is evil, why should that be something that's celebrated? Why should, because so many of those relationships end up being essentially abusive mm-hmm. towards the female. Like, why? I had a friend read my book and say, gosh, so many women are victims. And I said, well, it is a Victorian novel. I said, but that's also because the men either fail to or are incapable of protecting them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, a social problem that we see nowadays, where there's a lot of violent tendency towards women that is partly a result of feminism, because women do need to be protected and cherished.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like the Twilight, that's, I mean, as
a
mother,
Kristen Stewart character, yeah.
Exactly. I'm a mother, and I have three small children, and two of them are girls, and I would demolish a vampire-type bad boy who looked at my daughter, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's, and yet it is seductive in itself. Hey, listeners, if you'd like to jump into this conversation, I'm going to throw the number out, 714-282-6034. That's 714 2826034. We are talking with author Eleanor Borg Nicholson about a very unusual subject, the topic of her latest novel, A Bloody Habit. We're talking about vampires and sort of the gothic evils of the underworld, I guess you would have to describe it. Hey, so there were a couple of things about your novel that I want to ask you about. Very interestingly, because you were just speaking about the women are sort of the most vulnerable in this story, and of course it was Victorian London, but there is a convent that the women who have been preyed upon seek solace in and seek redemption and seek, you know, sort of absolutely to rid themselves of what has poisoned their system. And I think that's fascinating. Did that exist in England at all, or in any place where women can go and they are protected and safe from evil, outside evil forces?
You would have that in Catholic circles in terms of convents where you'd be sort of convalescing there. I did have someone say to me, what is that, 12-step for vampires? sort of, I guess, it's a 12-step program. And then my husband said, you know, that'd be more appropriate with werewolves. I said, well, these are victims. They're not strictly vampires. You can't redeem a vampire because they're undead. I mean, so that's where we went with that. But funny enough, I was doing research for a class. I teach for Homeschool Connections. I teach Victorian literature, and I was doing research on Charles Dickens, who I adore, but reading a little bit more deeply about his work for sort of safe homes for prostitutes, where they would try to redeem the women of the streets. And it was based on a sort of vaguely Christian, conflictedly Victorian humanism. But they were trying to save these women and to give them rehabilitative opportunities. I think that the Catholic Church historically has had more scope for rehabilitation than you see in the last couple hundred years, where the poor became, I mean, the welfare state was established, or the notion of welfare was established by the Elizabethans. Before then, you had the church that took care of the broken, the wounded, disabled. So similarly, you would have room, not strictly speaking for vampire victims, but for those who have been assaulted by evil in some way or woundedness and need the mantle of Mother Church to protect them.
Well, I love this line when the attorney is visiting this convent and they are explaining to him how the convent operates and that women come here for solace and they spend a lot of time in front of the Blessed Sacrament and they come for healing. And he says, how do they survive? How do they do? And, you know, the elderly are just old and they sort of often die from the assault. So he says, and the young, the quote is, they first must desire our help. The young are often not equipped to resist the glittering facade evil puts on for their benefit. I underlined that because I thought it was very profound. And that's Victorian England, but I think it's even more relevant today.
Definitely. And I think there are a lot of themes that resonate or have parallels today, even in the assault of the vampire. This is one of my justifications for my post hoc justification for the Dominicans, who, of course, were established in battling the Albigensian heresy. Mm-hmm. But at its heart, we're battling a dualism that either divides good and evil and puts them on a par, but also a dualism that divides the soul and body and either makes the body the subject of just, it doesn't matter, so it can just be pleasure, or it's evil and it must be crushed. Either way, it's wrong, and it's not a sound moral anthropology as we understand as Catholics. So I think that the temptation to evil, especially in the fallen human body, is so strong, and especially when they're young and they can't even think clearly. This is why I always say to my husband, Aristotle said you couldn't talk about ethics until you were 35. So you've got to mature. You've got to get there. And so many young people today, they have no equipment whatsoever. They can't come up with a logical understanding of anything, and they're just sort of thrown out with their disordered passions and not given those tools. It's a hard time to be a young person today.
Eleanor, I'd love to sit at your dinner table between you, this brilliant author, and your husband, the philosopher. That must be some lofty dinner time conversation going on.
Well, our children are very good at keeping us, you know, down at a level, but then sometimes they regurgitate things they've heard us say. not necessarily in the same form, and that's a little alarming.
Yes, they're quoting you, but they don't quite understanding you. Okay, one other thing I have to ask you about that's in your book. The Count, who is the vampire, and that might be a spoiler alert there, but he has this whole place of business where he's bringing in all kinds of people, and it looks like he's doing good. He's charitably helping them and giving them new opportunities to reinvent themselves and stuff. But at one point, Prince Edward or Bertie walks in there and is seen in there, who was the King of England in the turn of the century. What was that all about? And you just kind of dropped that, and I thought, whoa, was that going to go anywhere? Was that brought up again? I didn't quite see that theme brought out, but I thought, what do you suggest? I know he was kind of a naughty boy in his time.
He was very wild, he also came to Popescu as a social evening, and he appears there as well. So he comes more than once into contact. And I think that it's one of my beefs with Count Dracula, actually. His strategy is terrible. He should have had a cover story.
Yes.
When I taught Dracula to teenagers, I told at the end, one of their final assignments was to come up with one plot point that we could use if we were battling vampires, and one plot point we would use if we were trying to make Dracula's strategy better. And so we were
playing both sides there, huh? That's a good debate.
You need a better villain. You need a better villain who has a public front. You need to sell the product.
Yeah.
How would a vampire sell the product? Well, going for the sort of a Victorian fascination with, as I say, do-goodery, but also the fact that so many people in the upper levels of society, including the aristocracy, were deeply enmeshed in the occult.
Mm-hmm. That's weird, yeah. In such a proper, prim a facade of doing everything quite within the boundaries of good behavior. Then they, you know, dabble in this weird science of occult. Yeah, that's strange.
Well, and actually a good example is Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes stories. He was a lapsed Catholic, but he was also just heavily, heavily invested. That was what he wanted people to know him for, was his writings on spiritualism.
Oh.
It was very popular at the time, and I think it's a product of the growing secularization of the country, because they still have the impulses towards some sort of belief, and
they don't know where to channel.
How do they articulate them?
Yeah,
they've totally thrown religion out the window.
Yeah.
And so I threw Bertie in there a couple of times, partly because of his shady history, but also because I think it brings up it increases how important things are, that if Count Popescu can get a firm hold in London.
Yeah.
And
in the royal family. Yeah, I mean, within the highest ranks.
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting.
And then you can control the future of the British Empire. And what does that mean? You're impacting worldwide.
Yeah, that was a very salacious little detail you put in there. Hey, so Eleanor, we have a caller from Texas whose name is Kay. And I believe Kay has a question she'd like to pose to you. Hi, Kay. Welcome to Call Me Catholic. Do you have a question for our author, Eleanor Nicholson?
I do. I absolutely loved your explanation of how the bad boys have been made so attractive. And I need your advice on how to undo some damage that I think I've done. I have at the time she was 12, read the Twilight series, and it has become her absolute favorite book of all time.
There you go.
Rereads it. I didn't take the time to read it. I usually screen every movie, every book, every TV show my kids watch, but I didn't with her. And now, I mean, she's 13 and she's still, I haven't let her see the movies, but I know deep down that that was not a good thing for me to let her do. And she is now, you know, being able to go on group dates, co-ed group dates, and she's forming her opinion about boys and everything. And I see that this book has influenced her drastically. What advice do you have for me to kind of, you know, undo some of the damage that I've done by letting her have these ideas that the bad boy is a good thing? Exactly what you were talking about.
Okay, that's a great question, Kay, and I'm going to let Eleanor take it from here. What do you say to our caller, Kay? Eleanor?
First of all, be reassured. My sister-in-law, to whom I partly dedicated the book, used to tease her because she admitted that when she was dating my brother that she liked Twilight. And we're like, well, I guess we'll let you in the family anyway. I would say what I would do in that instance, just with my own children, I would probably sit down and say, all right, well, you're so interested in vampires. And I would do a course on vampires. I would read Dracula with her. You read my novel with her. I would sort of explore evil. But then the real important thing, I think, is guiding her to set aside the notions of evil and rebuild in her own mind what is a hero? What is a worthy man for me? And there are lots of Catholic resources on what it means to be a Catholic gentleman, to be a Catholic man. And I should also say, I have five brothers. I was raised with boys. So I had a lot of very down-to-earth experience of boys from a very early age. And it, I will say, made my standards extremely high when I read them.
Good brothers, then.
The age, they were awesome. They were tremendous. But they also let me see. I was never drawn in by the bad boy, but that was because I tended to be very dismissive of him. But I would say that if you can help her understand where vampires belong, but then also re-explore true romance, which you can get in so many places, not just Catholic sources, but the Christian literary tradition is just rife. If you can get her to read, even the Brontes, I wouldn't read Wuthering Heights because that'll just make it worse. But if you want to see how can you redeem the bad boy, what happens to the bad boy? Can he be redeemed?
Mm-hmm.
Look at Mr. Rochester and Jane Eyre, and he gets the nonsense beat out of him. But that would be my recommendation.
That's good. That's
again,
good.
My children are all under 10, so but just anticipating.
Well,
anticipating that
and we,
in the future.
And I totally relate to the fact that it got away from her and she started, you know, what the term Twilight doesn't seem like it has the, you know, essence of evil in it. So, Kay, did Eleanor's direction help you?
Yes, thank you. Is there also a resource for other reading materials? Like you could just go and say good examples of strong male hero types for tween readers? It's such a very badly populated segment of the population, and there's hardly anything good for tweens, but perhaps I'm overlooking, like you said, some of the classics, maybe.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see what Eleanor has to say about that. Can you make any recommendations for other reading, Eleanor?
Well, I would say I'm trying to think of ones that specifically are geared towards tweens, but I know that for me, when I was reading, if you can get it, even as an audiobook, to read Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm.
Just listen to Jane Austen. Look at those.
Girls love Jane Austen.
They do. Well, and the heroes are manly men.
Mr. Darcy.
And they expect the heroine to rise in virtue and intelligence. Mm-hmm. That's the goal of an Austen heroine, is to win a hero by being virtuous and mature yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be when I would go back to the classics, but that's also because that's where I'm happiest.
Yeah.
But I do know that there are a lot of Catholic writers today, even looking into, if you look up Catholic writers and see what they're doing, I know there are tween writers. I believe Regina Doman has written things for that age group.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure specifically what, though.
I think Jane Austen is a really good suggestion because girls fall in love with Jane Austen, and it's something a mother and daughter. I think the next choice should be something that you read together too. So I that would be a good direction, I think. And honestly, Kay, her book, A Bloody Habit, will reveal evil for what it is, will reveal the vampiric, lie for what it is. So, good luck
Excellent.
To you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much
it.
For calling in. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question that I'm sure a lot of parents have kind of fallen prey to the benign appearance of the Twilight series.
Well, and I think that it's light, and even when it first came out, my first reaction to it was, just whatever, not very well written, who cares?
You but thought it was just bad.
Watching
yeah,
it evolve, I was like, this is just pathetic. But then going on to it,
I think we're losing.
I have to read it first.
Well, it's like I said also in the beginning of my show, and you weren't there, but I was saying, you know, pop culture, the antidote for pop culture is classic culture. You know, go back in art, go back in literature, movies, and just kind of fill your brain with some of the really good old stuff that doesn't lead to sort of worshiping anything other than just a good story and the hero and the heroine and, you know, doing right in the end, which is always celebrated in those things.
And for young people who are struggling with, because they are longer, a lot of these books are longer and heavier, and it's not, yeah, it's sort of an acquired taste sometimes. I highly recommend audiobooks, especially even for my students who are struggling. If I assign them 3 Victorian novels in a semester, I'm like, can't you read these in a week? Say, well, if, you know, if you're struggling with them, maybe let's do an audiobook and let's work through it together. That I really liked your idea of doing it with your mother.
Yeah.
Work through it together and get it, because it's also a very beautiful experience to read with one's children, even keeping pace, even if you're not reading aloud, but pace with your children and talking through it.
Well, and there is great pleasure in just sharing conversation after you've experienced a good piece of literature, a good piece of art, a good film, a good, you know, musical concert. It's just, it kind of bonds you together when you've experienced it at the same time. I think it's very rich. Hey, so Eleanor, you also work for Ignatius Press. You've edited a lot of their work. What are some of the things that you have particularly enjoyed from Ignatius Press? What do you think they do best?
Oh, well, they definitely, I mean, theological texts, you know, the text, papal texts, I always turn to them. A lot of spiritual writing. I'm very thrilled that they've recently turned their attention to fiction.
I am too. I love that. I think there is so much to learn in the metaphors of fiction and the stories and in the, you know, detached plots and characters. It's like, oh, I see myself there. I see how this kind of behavior is unattractive, or I see how virtue really does look good and bear fruit.
And I think it's a really exciting time for Catholic writers, because we have a sort of conflicted history with the rise of the novel as a genre form, because, of course, it rose after the Reformation. And in the English tradition, the primary representation of Catholicism in those novels is hilariously anti-Catholic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just how it is. That was actually my specialization in the Victorian period, was anti-Catholicism, because it's all over their literature.
Yeah.
But
well,
I think that
you have definitely whet our appetite to go back and enjoy some of the classics from Lord Tennyson and Dickens and maybe even Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And our time has come to a close. But thank you, dear Eleanor Borg Nicholson. Friends, join us next week. Until then, I'm Peggy Normandin, but you can call me Catholic.
You've been listening to Call Me Catholic with Peggy Normandin, live from the Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove, California. Call Me Catholic is a co-production of EWTN Radio and Orange County Catholic Radio. Heard weekly on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.